Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. As the Synod for Africa wraps up here in the Vatican, Synodal Fathers and other participants at the meeting talk about the seeds planted during these past 3 weeks and of hopes and expectations of those back home. We bring you part 15 of our ongoing series, The Vatican Centuries. And leading up to Pope Benedict XVI's upcoming meeting with artists in the Sistine Chapel, we take a peek at a Michelangelo masterpiece on those very walls. Today I'm going to take up from where I left off last week. The Synod for Africa has been going for 14 days now, and participants are preparing to wrap it all up next Sunday. And as I told you last Monday, I have really been trying to make the most of the Synodal Fathers and of all the other participants too. I do that by popping down to the Synod Hall almost every day, and during their 10:30 coffee break, go up to them, introduce myself, and interview them, notwithstanding an inevitable background din of clinking coffee cups and conversation. 2 weeks ago, I asked them for their opinions regarding the role of the media in Africa. Last week, my question had to do with their expectations regarding this synod and what they hope it will produce.
How hopeful are you that the synod papers will actually have an effect once the synod is over and done?
I think, you know, after the first African synod, we probably had unrealistic expectations that great things would start happening immediately.
Cardinal Wilfred Fox Napier is the Bishop of Durban in South Africa, and he's also one of the delegate presidents of the synod.
But what has happened is, it's taken 15 years, and in some places, at the end of those 15 years, people are only now starting to realize why it is important to have a justice and peace commission in a diocese or even in a parish. It isn't about political injustice, it's about all other kinds of injustice and reorganizing society so there are no people who are disadvantaged that should be all on a par, given a fair chance. And I think those who were here for the previous one, those who have been in the process of trying to implement the previous synod, will be more realistic in saying, well, we know reconciliation is something very difficult. It's like, how would I say, trying to catch a shadow, because how do you reconcile people when they're at either end of a spectrum? And yet, I think what happens at a synod is a certain atmosphere, a certain spirit is planted in the hearts of people, which makes us realize, hey, we don't belong on the outside. We should be on the inside helping people find reconciliation, even if it's in the political field. The church must go in there, not because we want people to do things the way the church wants, but to see the things that are common to us, and the church is simply there as a catalyst to get them going.
So, a certain spirit is planted in the hearts of people during a synod such as this, says Cardinal Napier, as we strive to help people find reconciliation. Now, I don't think I've said as much so far, but reconciliation, together with justice and peace, are the main themes of this synod. And as Cardinal Napier, who's so creative with words and images, says, the Synodal Fathers are not here to catch a shadow, but to find common ground upon which to build. And that is definitely something I heard from others as well.
What do you expect from this synod?
I would hope that we will go back with a new sense of energy and enthusiasm.
Father Robert Patrick Ellison is the Bishop of Banjul in the Gambia.
It hasn't been easy for our local Catholics, say, to see things as we might see them here. You know, when you're talking with people who are leaders and like-minded, exactly, that's the word, and you go back to your own diocese, it's very hard to communicate the spirit of hope and the needs as we discuss them here. So that is the most important thing that I would have to do as head of the church, be able to communicate the fact that, yes, a lot of good has been done. Here are the areas where we must get up and go a little bit harder. As I said, the area of self-reliance, the area of perhaps even a little bit more commitment to the various, particularly to the poor and the needy in our diocese.
Another thing I have probably neglected to say so far is that, as well as the over 200 bishops who are participating in this synod, there's also a fair number of auditors and experts, men and women, involved in giving their contribution. Sister Cecilia Makonto, the General Superior of the Sisters of St. Bridget in South Africa, told me she is hoping for more collaboration between different members of the Church, as well as raising the voice of Africa within the Universal Church. What do you hope might come out of this synod?
We are hoping that we become more of a universal church, and Africa has a voice in the universal church. And on top of that, that we don't do our own thing, but we will align with Rome in whatever we are doing. And also the collaboration between the bishop and the major superiors, and then it filters down out to the grassroots where the people are working. And the involvement of lay people is counting a lot.
Another interesting woman I met was Sister Liliane Sueco of the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur. She's currently in Rome but has spent 7 years working in one of Africa's most ravaged nations, Zimbabwe. As is true for all those who work in Zimbabwe, she demanded respect for the people there and for her sisters who could find themselves in danger should she reveal anything the president of that country and his men may not want to be said.
Do you think that a gathering such as this will really bear some fruit as far as the concerns of real Africans go?
I believe, because God is working and we need to make known our voice. We need to make known our voice because it's the work of the Spirit, and the Spirit works through people. As we are here as a family of God, we believe, we know that we are going through a lot of suffering in Africa, but many good things also are happening, and we can contribute a lot in Africa.
Tell me about the good things.
Good things, but we have many values, for example, that we can say, and we can share with the world, we can share with the church. A such synod can be very fruitful to make known our voice, and many people are hearing what we are saying at this particular moment in our history.
So the need to make known the voice of Africa is paramount here in the Synod Hall right now. Cameroonian Bishop Jean Mbarga confirmed to me that this is true.
A meeting like this is important to bring all the voices together, right?
Yes, this one, the Synod, is has a good capacity of information first. To listen all this representation, it's very rich. And after that, we are looking for new strategies to improve our capacity to help the Africa, to help the society in Africa. And I think that at the ecclesial level, we have also this specific capacity to open the problem of Africa to the whole world. That is the universal aspect, which is very important. It's not only the problem by Africans to the Africans, it's now the problem of the world and the humanity, all the humanity.
Yes, it's a chance to bring news of the reality, know the many realities of Africa, both good and bad, to the rest of the world. As Bishop Mbarga says, to the whole of humanity. But it also works the other way. As Bishop George Biguzi of Sierra Leone told me, Africans back home are also awaiting for news.
What do the people of Africa want to hear coming out of this synod, in your mind?
Well, I believe that the Instrumentum Laboris already sets the goal. They want to hear, of course, people are looking for liberation from the troubles, for healing, again for greater justice, freedom from oppression, and also the all terrible wars of different types, so that people have to keep running here and there as refugees without security. So there are a lot of things actually that people expect. They know that the church doesn't have the magic wand, you know, to solve everything, and that a lot of things actually are responsibility of governments. Our responsibility as pastors is to be, as you say, well, prophetic, to bring the word of God and on the actual situation, inspire people, give direction, service. Well, the church has been doing this from the beginning, you know, our involvement in spreading the word of God, the dignity of the human being, and then all the social services that the church runs throughout the continent, in education, health, development, all sorts. So people look to the church, at least to lead in the way of development, of freedom, and reconciliation. So the expectations are many. We know that we are not God, we are God's servants, and I believe that with God's help, with the Holy Spirit, we can really do a lot moving forward to reconcile the people, to have a more just society and a peaceful coexistence.
In his comprehensive answer there, Bishop Biguzzi touched on the issue regarding the responsibilities and the challenges of leadership. This is an issue that the Archbishop of Johannesburg and President of the Bishops' Conference of Southern Africa, Father Buti Tlagale, spoke to me about at length. Actually, very courteously, upon my invitation, he came to the radio himself for a quiet chat away from the din of coffee cups and background conversation. What is your hope that the synod may create? Or you're going to go back to South Africa. What do you think the people in South Africa want to hear from you?
I guess we're probably at slightly different expectations. My expectation of the synod is that we will speak in one voice, be a visible leadership across boundaries. Select one or two or three things we want to put up a fight about and do it and seek to achieve results. That's what I would like to see happen. I would like to see a committed leadership, a collective leadership, an accountable leadership.
You said something interesting. You said the unpleasant challenges of leadership, you
called
it.
Unpleasant in the sense that most, when these things come up, when we fear reaction from the people we criticize and we want to back away. And also, if you take, for example, the example of Pius Ncube, look what has happened to him. It could happen to any of us.
You may or may not remember, but Pius Ncube, the former Archbishop of Bulawayo in Zimbabwe, was widely known for his human rights advocacy and for being an outspoken critic of Zimbabwe's president. He was quite clearly framed and forced to resign in 2007 after calling for a peaceful rebellion to bring democratic change to his suffering nation.
So when we challenge the political leadership with all the might they have, they might actually turn around and make your life impossible. So by virtue of being in a position of leadership, you have access to a certain level of support of the people by virtue of that position of responsibility, but people also expect you to take certain risks. And it is those risks that I'm referring to, that they can be very unpleasant, some of those challenges. And we have to be stand up and be counted. If we did that together, obviously in our situation at times we have to do that as individuals where we are concretely, but as a country, for example, we've got to do that as a collective, so too across the region. I mean, if you look at SADC, the political level, we've got SADC, And then we've got the AU at a continental level. Even politicians feel the need of working together at those levels. So to the church, you know, we've got to work together. If we succeed in doing that, in having a common commitment, then we will be able to produce results. We won't just make claims. We'll be able to follow through on the promises we make to the people we serve. Our job is simply to serve communities. And if they feel oppressed, deprived, we've got to speak on their behalf. And if we do that without fear, without favor, then we will be doing our job. So I think in many ways the expectations are that since you claim to be leaders or we've put you in position of responsibility, behave like leaders and help us, help alleviate the pain, the poverty, the stress of the people. That's what we're called to do.
Yes, if all those in positions of leadership accept the challenge and really behave like leaders, if they all follow through on the promises they make to the people they serve, as Bhuti says, without fear and without favour, a big step is sure to be made in the alleviation of the pain and of the poverty of all African people. And on a totally different note, Jill Bevilacqua presents the next in her series on the Catholic Church, the Vatican Centuries.
Chapter 15, The End of the Millennium.
The last phase of the Dark Ages had begun. As the legend of Charlemagne faded, Christian Europe found itself in the grip of a dual fear. Fear of attack from the north by the buccaneering Vikings and from the south by the Saracens.
Already in the last decade of the 8th century, the blonde Danes had brought terror and destruction when they sacked Lindisfarne, or Holy Island, off the Northumbrian coast, carrying off precious booty and killing many of the monks.
Alcuin wrote a lament on the atrocity, and in his poem he sang of the fall and decline of so many great cities, Rome included. His words were almost prophetic.
Now the dear house of God where Peter's body lies, the prince apostle, men say is now laid waste by treacherous hands, her precious things their loot. And Rome, the crown and the flower, Rome that was golden, a heap of wild ruins now, thy glory down beaten with swords, a huddle of shabby roofs men see thee now, sullen, sunken, alone.
The Eternal City was only a shadow of its former self, despite the rich furnishings of the church over St. Peter's tomb.
This had now seen some 500 years of life, and in that time the great church built by Constantine had been the recipient of the votive offerings of kings, popes, and emperors. By the middle of the 9th century, it could truly be considered the richest museum in Europe.
But in a short time, Rome was to be devastated once again. For one morning, in the August of the year 846, 70 Moorish ships crept stealthily up the Tiber.
There are no chronicles of the Saracen invasion of Rome, so it is not known whether they attempted to make an attack on the city itself. As the Aurelian walls were still in good condition for defence, it's thought that the Romans probably succeeded in keeping them out, and that the Turks made no attempt to scale the walls. Instead, they sacked Trastevere, which was undefended, and rifled the basilicas of St. Peter and St. Paul, both of which were outside the walls.
The Roman colony of Saxons, Lombards, Frisians, and Franks did their best to defend the Borgo area around the Vatican, but they were overcome by the superior forces of the enemy, and soon the sacred hill was abandoned to the mercy of the infidels.
The raiders carried off Constantine's golden cross, Pope Hadrian's chandelier, and the silver altar table which Charlemagne had presented to Pope Leo on the occasion of his coronation.
The silver wrought work on the main door was wrenched off, and the gold on the floor of the confession.
The marauders stole the main altar and devastated the crypt, but the bronze sarcophagus of St. Peter was too heavy for them, and they had to be content with forcing the lock and scattering or destroying the contents.
But although the invaders carried off many precious spoils, they never discovered the tombs. For Pope Sergius II had known for months that they were coming, and had time to wall up the tombs and conceal perfectly the entrances to the vaults where they were situated.
6 months later, Sergius died and was succeeded by Leo IV, a pope who was to make his own particular mark on what we know now as Vatican City.
Rome was still in a state of shock, made worse by an earthquake and then by a fire which broke out in the Saxon quarter. The wooden roofs of the houses were soon a prey to the flames, and the Borgo was quickly reduced to ashes.
The legend runs that as the fire spread in the direction of St. Peter's, the Pope came out on his balcony, made the sign of the cross over the flames, which suddenly died down.
The Saxon area of the Borgo was not rebuilt until some years later, when King Ethelwulf of England came to Rome on pilgrimage, bringing with him his 7-year-old son Alfred. The English king and his son were given a great welcome by the Pope, and they in their turn brought a great chest full of gifts for St. Peter, including a crown of pure gold and a silver gilt candelabrum.
The English visitors must have listened to many a tale of that dramatic time from those Saxons who had fought the Saracens and seen the Borgo in flames. It's recorded that King Ethelwulf rebuilt and restored the Saxon quarter. He was the first Saxon king to grant tithes to the church, and he reaffirmed the hearth tax, formerly imposed on English homes for the upkeep of the colony. Peter's Pence, as it came to be known, continued to be paid until Henry VIII abolished it in 1534.
It was during the years of reconstruction that the Saracens made their second attempt to attack Rome. This time, they approached from Sardinia, but the Christians were ready for them and attacked first. A violent storm then blew up, and the enemy, unused to sea battles, was overwhelmed.
The survivors were taken to Rome and, ironically, were put to work on the reconstruction of the city and the new Leonine fortifications around the Vatican Hill. This, Pope Leo IV's greatest work, was begun in 848 and completed in 852.
The whole of the Vatican territory, which was also known as the Portico of St. Peter's, was enclosed within the new walls. These began at Castel Sant'Angelo, stretched along and up the Vatican Hill, curved round behind St. Peter's and down in a straight line to the river.
Entry to the new city was through three gates, two of which were placed at the castle end of the wall. One was small, the other, larger, was the main entrance, and it was by this gate that emperors made their entrance to the Vatican. The third gate connected the new city with Trastevere and was called Posterula Saxonum because it stood in the Saxon quarter.
When the wall was completed in 852, it was given the name of Civitas Leonina, and a great ceremony took place to celebrate its completion. All the hierarchy, barefoot and with ashes on their heads, walked the length of the wall singing psalms. At the head of the procession walked the 7 cardinal bishops, who sprinkled the wall with holy water. At each of the gates, the procession halted, and the Pope prayed for a blessing on the new city.
We only belong to yesterday, and yet already we fill your kingdom, towns, castles, villages, societies, academies.
All the peoples we rule shall practice that religion which the divine Peter the Apostle transmitted to the Romans. We shall believe in the single deity of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit under the concept of equal majesty.
The empire of Charlemagne was no more. The dream had turned out to be a delusion. Europe was moving inevitably towards feudal anarchy. And as the first 1,000 years of Christianity came to an end, people wondered what the new millennium would bring.
You've been listening to a programme written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett. Leading up to Pope Benedict XVI's meeting with artists in the Sistine Chapel, scheduled for November the 21st, Veronica Scarsbrick takes a look at some of the Michelangelo masterpieces there. She does this with Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis. So stay tuned.
This is the fourth prophet we've done. His name is Daniel.
Yes, Daniel, one of the major prophets.
One of the major prophets, mm-hmm. Daniel and the lion. There's no lion there.
Well, there's no space for him.
But he's a big figure, and yeah. There's a lot of blue and yellow and green. Brown. I'm not quite sure. There's a lot going on there, Breda.
Well, what strikes you here is the quantity of movement. We always have these two little putti each side, acting like caryatids and holding up, let's say, the throne. These four look like they're having a rave up, like some kind of a party. They're all over the place. Look, dancing and moving. And it's incredible, actually, the way they're making faces at each other almost. And then Daniel himself. I mean, the figure of Daniel here, the part at the top, has been slightly damaged also by infiltration of water here, actually. That's another problem. And again, Daniel, he's reading a book. As you can see, it's open on his lap. And you have behind him a very vague figure, which is not so clear. It's like the figures behind Creator in the Genesis scenes. Not so highly defined in the painting. And then you have him looking very intently from the book to a writing desk at the side where he's actually using some charcoal, writing down notes, etc., from the book he's reading. And this kind of charcoal was used by Michelangelo for his earlier drawings as well. So you see this movement where one half of him is using his energy to hold the book and the other half is leaning forwards almost into the chapel and writing the news that he has to write. He has blue again all around the top part of the figure, this lovely cobalt blue, this lovely blue.
It looks
blue.
Very stressed too.
Well, more than stressed, I think it's the figure has been slightly distorted. So in actual fact, what he's doing, he's very concentrated. He's literally like squinting his eyes and writing intensely. It's an intensity that I get here. Because also, you have all this movement. The figure is gigantic. One foot here, as you can see, is darker. One foot is lighter. You have a type of a fringe shawl that he's wearing wrapped around him here. Then you have yellow and gold and a little bit of this violet that you find in the Creator as well. So the importance of Daniel. And what's very striking for me is you have this figure just below at his knees holding up this gigantic book. The book seems almost too big for the person. And the figure holding up the book is almost acting like a lectern. So instead of having, a construction to have the book on and from which he's reading, you have a human being, a small nude figure, acting as a lectern. There's something very sweet about it. Meaning, again, his love of the human figure, his love of humanity, and involving humanity even in holding up a book for some other human being to read.
Thanks there to Veronica Scarsbrick. And of course to Breda Ennis, Professor of Fine Arts at the American University of Rome.
Laudato Jesus Christus.